David overcame Goliath with courage and wit. The Philistines, originally from Crete, were voyagers who settled alongside the coast of ancient Palestine. The Israelites clustered in the mountainside region of Shephelah under the leadership of King Saul. Over time, the Philistines began to move upwards toward the Valley of Elah, a famous valley, over which many wars and battles were fought. They planned to claim half of the Israelites' territory, and they were battle-experienced. The two kingdoms set up camps on either side of the mountain with the Valley of Elah in the middle. The Philistines sent Goliath down the ridge. He was a 6'9" giant with a lance, spear, sword and full-body armor. The Israelites sent no one down because they didn't think they would win over Goliath, their terrifying opponent, until David volunteered. When David appeared before King Saul, Saul tried to give him a fighting chance by outfitting him with his sword and armor, but David couldn't walk in them, so he refused. David went down the Elah Valley, carrying only his shepherd's staff, some stones, and a leather sling, and with these he killed Goliath. Oftentimes, we are drawn to stories of lopsided conflicts, stories of underdogs battling against all odds and coming out victorious. But in reality, we misread the odds, assuming they are heavily stacked against them. The same qualities that appear to give the giants strengths are often their sources of weakness. The story of David and Goliath teaches us that giants are not always what they seem. Your weakness is your most significant advantage. Vivek Ranadive, who had no experience playing or coaching basketball, successfully coached his daughter's basketball team of untalented and inexperienced young girls to the national championship. They did this by trying things no one else ever dreamed of. The Indian immigrant knew his team's greatest weakness was their lack of experience. Building on that weakness, he came up with an unconventional strategy to unleash full court pressure, all the time. This is because the young girls, mostly 12-year-olds, did not need to have a background in basketball to play strong defense. The girls took advantage of the weak points in basketball and were able to usurp talent with their determined attempt. Ranadive, who grew up in Mumbai with only crickets and football as the primary sport, was familiar with one crucial aspect of all sports regardless of experience, winning. The disadvantage of inexperience in basketball ended up being an advantage because it freed them up to playing unconventionally. The girls' inability to shoot, pass, and dribble, their most significant disadvantage, turned out to be what made their winning possible. Ranadive decided that the best way to keep the better trained and more talented opposition from winning was never to give them a chance to have the ball. He, therefore, taught his girls to win by being aggressive defensively, which got them to the finals.
Having too many resources isn't always in our best interest.
The upside-down parabola is used to illustrate the relationship between not having enough and having too much. This theory is connected to class sizes and wealth. Over the past few years, various countries, including the United States, have taken steps to cut down the quantities in classes. They believed that smaller class sizes allow for improved teacher-student interaction. However, that doesn't seem to be the case as reduced classes tend to lead to reduced discussion due to the lack of diversity. A man in Hollywood grew from humble beginnings in quaint Minneapolis. He started working from a young age, and by the age of 11, he had earned $600, which is equivalent to $5,000 today, by himself. He learned to value money and worked different jobs, changing his lifestyle when he needed to. This young man from middle-class Minneapolis worked his way to big deals and jobs in Hollywood, to the point where he now lives a wealthy life in a mansion the size of an airplane hangar in Beverly Hills. However, the Hollywood man believes his children wouldn't learn the long and hard way about the value of money and the meaning of work because of his success. As well as the joy and fulfillment that comes from making your way in the world just as he did. How do you teach, work hard, be independent, learn the meaning of money, to children who have always been surrounded by wealth and realize that they never have to do any of that or learn the meaning of money? The man from Hollywood was not the parent he wanted to be because he was too rich. Hotchkiss is an elite prestigious boarding school in Connecticut, USA. The tuition is almost $50,000 a year with an average of 12 students per class. The school boasts of two lakes, two hockey rinks, four telescopes, a golf course, and 12 pianos, in which two are the most prestigious pianos money can buy, the Steinway and Fazioli piano. Although Hotchkiss seems like the kind of school that spares no expense when it comes to its students, the school is not yet what it wants to be. Its classes are too small, leading to a lack of diverse interactions.
It seems the school thinks more about the parents who want to see their $50,000 well spent than its students. We all assume that being bigger, stronger and richer is always in our best interest. Vivek Ranadive, David, and the students of Hotchkiss School will tell you that isn't the case. Wealth contains the seeds of its destruction. Not venturing out of your big pool might hinder your success. When choosing universities, the most sensible thing to do would seem to go to the most prestigious one that will accept you. Then you'll be a small fish in a big pond, which can be damaging to your confidence in your abilities. The theory of relative deprivation says that we judge our skills based on the capabilities of those around us. For instance, if you attend Princeton and struggle in a chemistry class, you may feel that you're just not cut out for a career in science. While in reality, your skills in chemistry may be better than 70% of people in the world studying chemistry. When comparing yourself to your classmates at a prestigious school, you lose confidence in your abilities. When Caroline Sachs, a straight-A high schooler, was trying to decide which Ivy League college to attend for her science degree, her choice was between Brown University or the University of Maryland. She chose Brown but eventually gave up on pursuing a career in the sciences because she could not stop measuring herself against the other brilliant students. Comparing herself to her peers made her feel inadequate and intimidated in a way that a smaller university might not have. At a different institution, she could have been the top student. The more elite and exclusive an educational institution is, the worse students feel about their academic performance. Where they could have performed at the top of their class in any right school, they perform average, even woefully in an elite school. This phenomenon is referred to as the big fish little pond effect. It's better to be a big fish in a small pond than a small fish in a big lake. The French Impressionist painters chose not to conform over a century ago. Paris was the hub of art culture in France. Back then, every artist had one goal: get into the Salon, which was a gallery for all the most fabulous art within France. There was one problem though: the Salon forced artists to conform to what the Salon believed was real art, i.e. young men at war and fair maidens under trees. The famous French Impressionists, Pissarro, Degas, Cézanne, Renoir, Sisley, and Monet refused to compete for showings in the Salon as they believed that the Salon stifled their creativity. They decided to create their own new Salon with paintings that wouldn't have been approved by the Salon. In April 1874, 3,500 people attended their exhibition. This birthed the movement of Impressionism that wasn't accepted by the then-established cultural system of artistic judgment. The artists created entirely new ponds and flourished, rather than flounder against the tide in a lake of mediocrity. See disability as an advantage, not a disadvantage. We tend to gravitate towards those areas that we are naturally gifted in. Inversely, in our areas of significant weakness, the same thing happens. Disabilities might be considered a disadvantage, however, limitations force some people to compensate by developing extraordinary abilities in other areas. Dyslexia is a learning disability which affects the way people hear and manipulate sounds, read and process texts. A diagnosis is usually gotten between the ages of 8 and 9. For many people, having dyslexia can mess with their potential. Dyslexia affects not only academic achievements but also has psychological implications as it saps self-esteem and confidence. David Boies was born dyslexic. It meant that he subconsciously learned to listen well, memorize, persuade, and adapt swiftly. When he became an attorney, he often used these skills in the court to hear the weakness in the other side's argument as the tonality would differ slightly. Gary Cohn had dyslexia and grew up being comfortable with failure. This, however, made him not scared of taking risks and failing. This honed advantage helped him get his first job in the city by manipulating a high-up stockbroker into thinking he was an options trader, setting him up for a successful career in stock trading and eventually the president of Goldman Sachs. Sometimes, the things learned out of necessity are more powerful than the things that come easy. Don't give up, there is good in the bad. Tragic events can often lead to success because the victim learns to persevere. Contrary to the Germans' prediction during the Blitz in World War II against London, good things can come from the bad. Some social scientists divided people who have survived traumatic events into three groups. The first is the direct hits, the people primarily affected by the incident, the second is the near misses buckle under the weight of the shock and disbelief, and the last is the remote misses are people who are slightly removed from the trauma.
For these people, the death of a parent or an exploding wartime bomb strengthens them. Trauma leaves them better off than they were before. Because the worst had already happened and they survived, it created a fearlessness that would not ordinarily exist if the event hadn't happened. Rather than being profoundly affected by the traumatic event, they gained more confidence. These people actually felt invincible, and rather than let the event faze them, it inspired them, and they went on to live their lives with a more positive outlook. Emil J. Freireich is a man classified under a remote miss. His family suffered through the Great Depression, causing his father to commit suicide. His mother slaved in a sweatshop for 18 hours a day, 7 days a week to pay rent and other amenities. Jay had a brutally painful childhood. He was used to rejection and had to fend for himself. Drawing strength from his agony and loneliness, he set out to accomplish his dream of becoming a doctor. Jay had a bitter temper and no show of sympathy for his patients and their families. Working on the leukemia floor at the National Cancer Institute outside of Washington, D.C., Jay pushed for medical methods that were unheard of and seemingly dangerous. He dared to challenge the current thinking in place at the time and recommended giving patients a cocktail of hard drugs to try to kill cancer and almost kill his patients. From his unflinching and unconventional approach, Jay developed a successful treatment for childhood leukemia. As Gladwell so generously states, it is possible to emerge from even the darkest hell healed and restored. Wyatt Walker was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s chief strategists during the dramatic protests in the South at the height of the civil rights movement. Walker was forced to use tricks of deception and misdirection in order to gain traction for the campaign. Employing strategies similar to the trickster heroes of folk tales, he turned their weakness in numbers into a need for cunning. Gladwell argues that it, the bad, creates an act of courage to face anything because the worst has already happened, and you have survived it. A picture taken during the civil rights movement was used to highlight police brutality and draw sympathy from the public. Who would have known that one picture could spark something so huge? A picture was taken during a protest involving African American students from all around the Birmingham, Alabama area in 1963. This picture, which would later become famous, is of one of the student protesters being attacked by a police force's German Shepherd. The teenager seems to be standing there, calm-faced as though saying, "Take me, here I am." This picture would have not been taken or sparked such a response if it hadn't been for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his companions in the civil rights movement. Dr. King began his journey in Albany, Georgia, where he had been the underdog. Every African American of that time had been forced to be the underdog in almost every aspect of their lives. When it came to fighting for equal rights, they knew they had nothing to lose, and everything to gain. Wyatt T. Walker was a much more radical version of Dr. King, who used unconventional methods to get his point across. Walker was often compared to Br'er Rabbit. Br'er Rabbit was a character in African American culture who used his wits to get out of sticky situations. He wasn't a trickster by choice, but by necessity. Walker often made things seem like something else when they weren't. Regularly, Walker would pull pranks on Eugene Conner, the city's public safety commissioner. One example was when Walker said that the African Americans were going to march in the city. Not many showed up to the march, but as Walker delayed the rally, many more came out to watch. A mass number of spectators resulted in the miscalculation of actual marchers by a local newspaper. Walker also used African American school children to draw sympathy from the public. He sent them out to a local Baptist church instead of going to school. As they grew in numbers, Eugene Bull Connor used powerful fire hoses to keep the crowd at bay, and on the other side, he sent out his German Shepherd K-9 units, where the famed photo was then taken. Walker and the civil rights movement leaders used this to portray police brutality and draw sympathy towards their movement. Nobody would have thought that it was okay to use school children against the city's officials. Walker used what he had, and made tremendous strides in the civil rights movement in Birmingham, Alabama, which was considered the most racially divided city in America. Walker did meet with success using unconventional methods, and the civil rights movement continued to thrive even in the cruelest of places. When power is used correctly, it can start a revolution or be a catalyst for change. Rosemary Lawler, an Irish Catholic, survived as a newly wedded teenage mother during the conflicts between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. After being forced to move from their home in Belfast due to the unrest, the small family fled to Ballymurphy, an all-Catholic neighbourhood where their parents lived. However, in early 1970, things got worse in Ballymurphy, and the British Army who were called in to protect the citizens turned on Ireland, which forced the citizens of Northern Ireland to revolt. Lawler fought alongside many other women in an act to regain independence. As a result of the stupidity and brutality of the government, a revolution arose. The government's behavior is linked to the principle of legitimacy. How you punish is essential, if not more important, than the act of punishing itself. On the other end of the spectrum, Joanne Jaffe, head of the city's housing bureau in Brownsville, New York, found that showing juveniles love and sympathy led adolescents to make better choices. Unlike other authoritative figures who are depicted as the enemy, Jaffe showed the teenagers the opposite is true. To establish legitimacy, authority figures need to do lots of little things to show their respect. Another story that highlights the limits and influence of power takes place in June of 1940 after France fell to Germany. Germany allowed the French to set up a government in the city of Vichy. It was headed by Philippe Pétain, who complied with all of Germany's orders, by finding and sending all Jews to internment camps, and dozens of other authoritarian steps. But not all surrounding cities followed these steps, especially Le Chambon-sur-Lignon. It all began with one pastor, André Trichemy, who rebelled against anything the inner state enforced upon them. He started by telling all who listened to him not to listen to or obey anything that does not follow the orders of the gospel, which included going against the Germans' thoughts on Jews. As Pétain, the town mayor, was going around looking for all the Jewish men and women, Trichemy was taking them in for safety and security. This agitated Pétain. He counteracted Trichemy by sending Lamoran throughout the mountains teaching obedience to townspeople all around the mountain ranges. When Lamoran reaches Le Chambon, he is met by a town full of anger and hate for the subjects he is trying to teach or enforce. During this meeting, a group of students walked up to Lamoran and presented him a letter. The main message of this letter was, "We have Jews, you're not getting them." For years, the French people had to hide and create false documents to evade German forces. Trichemy was once arrested and told he would be set free if he signed a paper saying he would follow all the rules of the government. Trichemy, being a stubborn man, decided not to sign it, risking his own life and freedom. You may wonder where he got his stubbornness from? Well, when Trichemy was 10, he and his parents were headed towards their house in the country, and they had an accident. That day, he saw his mom lie lifeless in the middle of the road. Following the accident and trauma, he grew up to become resilient. His life was never the same. The pastor once told people, "Pine trees do not regenerate their tops. They stay twisted, crippled." He also said those trees do one other thing, they grow in thickness, perhaps, and that is what I am doing. Forgiveness is critical to our emotional health and beneficial to society. Mike Reynolds's daughter, Kimber, is a student at the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising in Los Angeles. She grew up in Fresno, California. Kimber was jumped by two men as she was coming from a date one weekend in June 1992. Although she willingly gave up her purse, she was shot by one of the men. Later that night, Kimber died while holding her dad's hand. The grieving father promised his daughter one thing as she lay on her deathbed, "I'm going to do everything in my power to try and prevent this from happening to anybody else." He did just that. That week, he held meetings in his backyard full of people he believed would make a difference. These women and men decided upon one thing: the penalties associated with breaking the law were too low. So they came up with the three-strike law, which meant that if someone is convicted of a second serious or criminal offense, he would have to serve twice the sentence currently on the books. Then if a third offense was made by the same person, the person being charged had to spend a minimum of 27 years to life in jail. Crime dropped by 36.6% after this law was passed. So, the question remains, did he do everything that he could? Yes, Mike did, but it also caused some significant repercussions. Think of it like this: if a guy goes through a stage in his life and racks up two offenses, then he turns his life around completely, but slips up one day and steals a piece of pizza from someone. The deadly pizza stealer is sent to jail for 25 years. See the flaw in this law? Gladwell describes it as an inverted U-curve because they believe the benefits of sending these men to prison far outweigh the negatives. Also, lawmakers believe that the men they are trying to send to prison tend to care less about the repercussions of what they have done but focus more on the benefits of the crime they break. Their minds are much different from ours. The man who killed Mike Reynolds's daughter later informed the police that he shot Kimber just because she looked at him wrong. Wilma Dirksen lost her daughter in a very similar situation. Her daughter was abducted, tortured, and found a month later in a barn outside of town. Do you think she reacted the same way as Mike did? No, she did not, because she was warned of the consequences she might face by a man who had his child murdered if she allowed her daughter's death to eat her alive mentally. Some would say the way she reacted was weird, not wanting to revolt, but she was born into a community where they believed in forgiving and forgetting. In the end, a man employs the full power of the state in his grief and ends up plunging his society into a fruitless and costly experiment. Conclusion. Sometimes, what we think is an advantage becomes a disadvantage, like Goliath's expertise, height, and resources. What we believe to be a weakness becomes great strength as we learn to compensate against it, like Bois with dyslexia. If you take away the gift of reading, you create the gift of listening and superb memory. You see the giant and the shepherd boy in the Valley of Elah, and your eye is drawn to the strength of the man's shining armor, sword and shield. However, what our attention should be on is the shepherd with his leather sling and stones. David gained more strength and purpose than we could ever imagine by capitalizing on his weaknesses and thinking out of the box. Try this: whenever you are faced with giants of different nature or circumstances, do not be afraid. Find out what your weaknesses are, then compensate for them by developing other areas of strengths and unique skills.